Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture podcast, coming to you from the megacity metropolis of Toronto. I am your host, Eric Anthony. This is episode 150. So for a big 150 anniversary, I had to bring in my good friend, Chatting with Chapman, Adam Chapman himself, and we are continuing our talks about the Spider-Man clone saga, debacle, whatever you want to call it. Adam Chapman, welcome back to the show. How's it going?
It's going well. I mean, with an intro like that, so it's an auspicious episode. It's episode 150. That's exciting. It's an anniversary episode. We're somehow ruining it with the clone saga, but then I'm there to rescue it a little bit, so it should be exciting.
It's all about the fun, Adam. It doesn't matter if the books are good or not good. It's all about how much fun we're having and how much fun the listener's having. With that said, it's been a little bit of time has gone by since I've read these. I have read them the last couple months, but I'll probably be a little bit foggy. So if you're a listener thinking I'm going to get the most in-depth clone saga breakdown, it won't be coming from me. It'll probably be coming from Adam. So thank you for joining us, Adam.
Absolutely. Well, I should point out, as I point out every time I ever talk about the clone saga, is that people should check out the Life of Riley archives online, because it is the most exhaustive kind of behind-the-scenes commentary on the clone saga that you're ever going to find. It recaps everything in excruciating detail, and then it has Glenn Greenberg, who was an assistant editor at this time, providing background commentary on what was actually happening. So if you really want the kind of the down-and-dirty stuff, you should definitely go check that out. One thing I want to mention before we talk about, we're going to pick up with book four of the Complete Clone Saga Epic Collections, but on book three, now they don't number these pages just to make things more difficult, but if one were to pick up volume three, and if they were to find the page or the where the issue Web of Spider-Man 124 occurs, on the, I believe, the one, two, three, on the fourth page of this issue, I can say that the original art is actually currently in my house, about to be given to my brother-in-law for his 40th birthday. He loves the Scarlet Spider, so we're able to find this page of original art by Stephen Butler, I should say. And it's he loves the Ben Reilly, but it's hard to find a good shot of Ben Reilly, you know, full on anywhere. So this is a shot where it's actually behind him, but you have the costume. It's very clearly who it is, and it's the original art. So that is currently in my house as we speak.
You know, I was just about to run to my shelf to grab the book, but I realized my book is inside my storage unit in the apartment, so I wouldn't have easy access. Now I want to know what the picture is.
I could probably find a shot of it somewhere. I could scan the original art or take a picture of the original art and send it to you. But yeah, no, it's pretty cool. Like my brother-in-law again loves Scarlet Spider. He named his son Ben after the Scarlet Spider, so it's obviously a big deal. So when he was turning 40, really was racking my brain with my friend Nate, who's been on the show before in the past, about what would be the best gift to get him in terms of original art. And original art can get pretty pricey.
Yeah.
Like there was one shot that actually it ended up not being for him, but I found this shot from Mark Bagley from Amazing Spider-Man 396. It's one of the first Spider-Man comics I remember reading. I remember I was given it to it as a gift, and then I had to find the part. Actually, it ended up being part three of Back from the Edge, which is part of the Clone Saga. Anyways, I was like, oh my God, and I'm not a big fan of this actual artwork retailer who ended up having it because all their prices are overly inflated. And I think it was like $1,500 and it already sold. Wow. I'm like, that's crazy pants. Because I've actually found a lot cheaper artwork by the same artist at different places, like Mark Bagley art, for much more affordable. Anyways, we ended up, racking our brains trying to find a good shot of the Scarlet Spider full on, and this was as good as we could get that wasn't going to be crazy or breaking the bank, and I'm very excited about it.
That's an awesome gift, especially knowing that Scarlet Spider means so much to him. I'm sure he's going to be over the moon with this.
So what's funny is that for years, so I guess maybe 94, 95, my babysitter at the time, her daughter had gotten married, and her husband, I guess, had a bunch of comics, and he didn't really care about them, and it was just like kind of throwing them at me. And they were like, Web of Spider-Man, who cares, right? Like, it was not a great period for Spider-Man, and it was always kind of the fourth title of four, right? Like, it was never the best title. And so I have had two issues of Web of Spider-Man 124 for like forever, and now I'm like, perfect. It's a great throw-in. I'm going to give him the comic and the original art from the comic. That's cool.
Yeah, it is pretty awesome. Very nice. Well done, Adam Chapman. Well, will your brother-in-law listen to this before
Thankfully, no. He actually doesn't listen to podcasts. He's been on podcasts with me before. I don't think he's ever actually sat down and listened to any of them, so I actually don't have to worry about it. Plus, this isn't even my own show.
He could, because it's a Scarlet Spider-Man, he might stumble upon it. Like, oh, Adam's on this. They're talking about the spider.
Not going to happen.
Okay, so he's like your wife. He doesn't listen to podcasts.
He doesn't even have Facebook. Like, he has no social media. He has no way of finding this, and he's never going to, like, go on iTunes. He has Samsung, so he doesn't even have iTunes. Like, I am safe.
Good, good. Okay, awesome. Well, you got to let me know what his reaction is when he gets it.
I'm very excited. Like, I'm not good at the holding on. Like, I just want to give gifts, you know? Like, my wife would be like, I really want a gift. And I'm like, here it is.
Yeah, I'm like that too. My wife gets mad at me all the time. She ruined every surprise. You don't know how to give a gift and wait. I'm like, well, I'm just so excited to give it to you. Why don't you be, you know, like, why aren't you happy that I'm just so excited to give you a gift? But we can't win. We're suckers.
Nope. We can't win. So let's start with this big fat volume, the Complete Clone Saga Epic Volume 4. It's definitely one of the fatter volumes. Once they switch over to the Ben Reilly epics, they get really slim. Mm-hmm. Even though there's six volumes, they probably could have just compressed it into five or four. Whereas with the actual Clone Saga epics, they're still pretty thick volumes, except for Volume 5, which is a little thinner.
I found the Volume 5 to be thicker, actually.
Copy that. Really?
Yeah, the copy I have, it feels like it, I think it has like 20 issues in it.
No, it's pretty thin. The Clone Saga Epic Volume 5, it's pretty slim compared to, like, you put it right next to it, it looks like you could almost have two of them.
I'll send you a picture. I'm not lying. This one is pretty thick.
I want to believe that yours, either mine is missing issues or yours is like got ridiculously thick pages.
Okay, do you want to see what's on the, I don't know if it's a printing thing or how they set it up, but this is, yeah, I think it has like 20 issues in this sucker.
Okay, well, what's the printing? This is scintillating audio for your listeners, but on the front cover, it tells you which printing it is. Which printing do you have?
2007 printing. 2017, what? Sorry.
Okay, so not first printing.
No.
Mine is a first printing.
That's probably why. Yeah, no, this was a pretty hefty volume. I'll send you a picture after the show. You'll be surprised.
Because, yeah, for me, it's like it's much slimmer than the rest.
Oh, okay. What's on the collected on the back of yours? Does it say?
All right. So we got New Warriors 62 to 64.
Yep.
Amazing Spider-Man 405 to 406.
Amazing Spider-Man. Yep.
The Amazing Spider-Man Super Special Flipbook.
Everything on this cover is in a different order.
Oh. So yeah. Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man 228 to 229.
I'm lost already. I'm already lost. I can't find it.
Wow. What version do you have? That's crazy.
Yeah. I'm sure it looks exactly the same with the same covers, but it's got everything you mentioned, so Web of Spider-Man 128, 129, ASM 405 to 406, Spider-Man 62 to 63, Spider-Man Unlimited number 10, Spectacular Spider-Man 228 to 229, Spider-Man Team Up 1, plus material from Amazing Spider-Man Super Special, Spider-Man, all the super specials that were on that flip book, and Web of Spider-Man Super Special.
Interesting.
Yeah. No, but this was a pretty hefty volume. I mean, I don't know if it's printed on thicker paper, like you said, but when you were like, oh, it's much thinner, Volume 5, I was like, huh, not mine.
I wonder. It's so interesting. You know, I'm checking the digital collections because obviously it tells you exactly how many pages are in it. And actually, according to this, the fifth volume is actually thicker than the fourth.
Yeah.
Which I don't know. How is that even possible?
Yeah, no. They look pretty on the shelf. They look pretty similar. Maybe the fourth one might be a little bit looks a little bit more content, but very similar.
Wow, I'm curious. You know, at some point we're gonna have to put our volumes next to each other and just see how crazy it is.
This sounds so inappropriate, but yes. Okay, let's talk about what's inside the Volume 4 of the Epic Clone Collection.
So the Volume 4 is, there's a lot that goes on here. It kind of goes in and out of good stuff and bad stuff, but it actually starts on a pretty solid note, which is Web of Spider-Man 125. The original cover had a hollow disc in the middle of the spider heart, and it has Spider-Man about to kiss Gwen. I'm a big sucker for Gwen, so I'm a big fan of that. If you jumped into this not having read what the issues that came before it, you would be super confused because you have Scarlet Spider, but you have Ben Reilly is actually in prison, and Peter is actually in the Scarlet Spider costume. So pretty confusing.
Yes, totally.
It's interesting to read this again in retrospect because you have a character show up here, but you don't really know who it is. But it, you know, you get introduced to the new Green Goblin. There's some hints as to who it's going to be, but we don't know who that is until that series actually would end up coming out later on in the same year that this was published. So at the time, this is, you know, an exciting new Green Goblin gets introduced in this particular issue.
And he's trying to be a hero as opposed to another supervillain for Spider-Man.
Yeah, which is, you know, a different route to take, and at the time would have definitely felt weird. I'm a big fan of Butler and Emberlin as a team, so I love the artwork in this book. It's really got a lot of energy to it. It's bright, it's colorful. Yeah, it's got some, you know, crazy anatomy that doesn't always make sense. Like there's a shot of Black Cat jumping off a rooftop, and I guess in the middle of jumping off the rooftop, she's taking off her jacket. Like it doesn't really make any sense. But it looks cool, so that's all that matters in this period. And it's got an interesting story about a clone of the Jackal who, you know, Ben Reilly is kind of hunting down and finding, and then he finds this version of Gwen who's there. She's the original, clone who then disappeared later, so from the original clone saga, which is already confusing. The only problem with the Green Goblin here is that when you have McDaniel later introduced the character, very kind of different vibe. Not really look like it's obviously the basic concept is the same, but it looks completely different when McDaniel does it.
Right. So when you say the original Clone Saga, that's the one that takes place or that was written
in the 70s
where they initially introduce Gwen Stacy coming back to life and Peter Parker's clone, which is now returned back. So with all the Clone Saga talk, I just feel like we got to kind of clarify that for people that are listening. Like, what?
Yes, the original.
The original. Which was pretty good. I like the original, actually.
Yeah, it's good. What I like about this issue is that it has one of those things which is definitely a trope that's been done a lot, but I feel like at the this time it hadn't been done as much, and that's the idea of Peter knowing how Gwen Stacy died, and then whenever someone gets dropped off a high height, him knowing how to make sure that they don't get hurt, and that he slows their fall and is able to, you know, protect them and save them, as opposed to just, you know, hurting them like he did with the original Gwen. Nowadays, it's very played out. It's happened all the time. But I feel like at the time, it was relatively, you know, rare to kind of see him confronting that idea. And here, it's actually Gwen, so it obviously adds an extra level of poignancy.
Yes. No, it's something I have noticed as well, and I like that they kind of make that call back to do this right. Like, this is a character who's oftentimes facing a similar sort of problem with a loved one being thrown off of a building, him living in New York City, but now he knows how to not make the same mistakes. I like that aspect of the character learning from his failures.
Now, in the back of this, you have a backup story which kind of explains more about this version of Miles Warren, but it's super creepy. Creepy for different reasons, but creepy just because you have like this older man basically trying to come up with a way to seduce this very young girl. Right. And then you also have, you know, him creepily having clones and then kind of die around them all. Like, it's just really super weird. The artwork by Lackey and Smith is very reminiscent of something you would see from, with heavy inks from like a Buscema of this area of this period, or, not necessarily Buscema, but, what's his name? Sekovich.
Yeah.
Because very heavy inks. It's not the greatest story. It's an interesting little kind of side backup story, which kind of adds a little bit more depth to the main story. But you also didn't need it. But because the first story was just so solid on its own. And again, it was a nice anniversary issue, great art, and a fun story.
Yeah, it was creepy. I don't know how well this would fly today with people reading it.
Yeah, I don't think it would work out that well.
No, I don't think so.
Now, issue 402, so this is the Bagley show, so everything that Bagley does in this period, generally speaking, is usually pretty good, mm-hmm. even when you have a lot of different inkers, because here he has, I think, three inkers working on them, but I think actually one of the pages I was looking at, but it was just way too expensive, was the first major page of this book, where you have Scarlet Spider walking into, and it's not the real Scarlet Spider, and that's part of why we didn't buy it, because although it's cool because it's the costume, it's Peter, it just feels disingenuous to be like, hey, you love Ben Reilly. Here's the costume, but that's not actually Ben Reilly.
Right. So what is it about? Do you find that there's an actual distinct difference between Peter Parker and Ben Reilly, or is it the costume that we love?
It's a little bit of both, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I don't think as simple as just being able to kind of strip it down. At the time, Ben Reilly was a return to kind of fun, exciting Spider-Man stories where at the time, Peter had been embroiled in a lot more stuff that kind of really pushed him as a character. And part of that was by design because they wanted to show a big gap between the two when they introduced Ben Reilly as a character. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's why people kind of liked him. And then they gave him a personality of his own. Like once he took over the book with Spider-Man, you know, he was similar to Peter, obviously, because they're the same. But he had different experiences which pushed him in different directions. And it wasn't like you were just reading a Peter Parker book. They did give him his own supporting cast and he interacted with him in a different way. So I think that's what people kind of liked about Ben.
Yeah, and at this time, too, like, as these books carry on, Peter is, again, kind of losing – not kind of. He's losing it bit by bit or going through these moments where a different thing is throwing him off of his rocker. So Ben Reilly is kind of that steady sort of Peter that we're used to, whereas the one that we've thought was our Peter is off of his rocker quite often in these next couple of issues, I find.
Yeah, especially with what you're about to see. Yeah. But now these two issues that we're talking about now are kind of just crazy issues about, you know, the Judas Traveler, who's kind of this weird MacGuffin of the period, where this super powerful character who seems to, you know, be able to be very godlike, not really a Spider-Man character. And now eventually he gets a retcon, which kind of calls all of this into doubt. But this is kind of a weird issue where it's, you know, Peter confronted by Judas Traveler, worrying about, you know, the soul of Aunt May. Just kind of a lot of mindless fighting. I don't find this issue to be doing a lot to kind of move along the overall saga of Peter Parker being in prison, Ben Reilly technically at the moment. It's DeMatteis, so I feel like he was trying to do a larger meditation on character and on being a hero, but to me, I didn't really enjoy this issue or the Spider-Man 59 either.
This is, if I remember correctly, just flipping through, this is one where there's a future that is potentially going to happen that Peter is at fault for. Am I correct in remembering that?
No, you're correct, yeah.
Okay. I remember, I think, liking the concept of it, but again, like you said, the payoff at the end was kind of like a detour from the story that you're really wanting to catch up on, which was Peter being tried for, or Spider-Man, Peter Parker, whatever, however you want to make sense of it, being tried for a murder or murders, and him and the clone switching places in order for justice to be found for the character. So was a little bit of a detour. It's like, well, why did we end up there? But it was fun, I guess. If you're reading it monthly, you might have had enjoyed it.
Yeah, and to be honest, I feel like I read it. I wasn't reading Spider-Man comics at the time, but I had a friend who had a bunch of issues, and I remember reading these two issues in particular. So like, I liked them at the time, but they're a little mindless, mindless is the wrong word, because it is DeMatteis and he is doing something, but as a kid, I don't think I really respected it or appreciated it enough, but he gave me great Mark Bagley artwork on the first half, so it was okay. The second half, it's Tom Lyle, but he's only doing the breakdowns, and it's exceptionally noticeable because I love Tom Lyle. He does some great art. This is not the best because you have Sam De La Rosa doing the finishes, and I think it's very noticeable that he's just doing the breakdowns. You know, he's not doing all of it because there's just some stuff here where the anatomy's off, and it looks a little bit like Lyle, but not quite enough. It doesn't have all the details that Lyle would usually put in.
Yeah, speaking of Lyle, I enjoyed his artwork during this time, but the stories that he was getting in Unlimited, I felt kind of dragged on sometimes. So as much as I liked his art, his scripting wasn't necessarily something that I was enjoying story-wise. But it was nice to look at, for sure, especially if you're a kid reading this in the mid-90s. It was very action-heavy, like you said before, very colorful and a lot of movement going on.
Next up, we have Spectacular Spider-Man 225. So again, another anniversary issue with, I believe, a hologram on the cover. You have Tom DeFalco writing it, and Sal Buscema doing the pencil breakdowns with Bill Sienkiewicz doing the finished art. And I don't think that these two are good fits for each other.
How come?
Well, first of all, I just think the Sienkiewicz is too dark and muddy for Buscema's pencils, and it just kind of clouds it out, and it makes everything look more angular and angry looking, and it's just so dark, and I feel like if you look at, there's a shot here where you get a good frontal of the, that doesn't sound right. of the Green Goblin kind of flying forward after he becomes the Green Goblin. And it's just, it's so overdone. And again, this is a, Buscema's a guy who did Spectacular Spider-Man 200 only 2 years earlier. And that was very kind of light brush inks. And it just worked so much better. And there was a lightness and still a menace. It got it all across. Whereas I thought this was trying so hard to be edgy and moody that it kind of clouded out detail. And to be honest, just kind of made the entire thing look murky.
Do you think that's what they were going for, though, to make it cloudy and moody, and because of this, of the time of Peter Parker?
I mean, it's possible, absolutely, but I think they went too far.
Yeah, it's a little heavy-handed. Like, it's definitely, there's a thickness to the inks where it almost takes away from Sal Buscema's, like, the form of his drawing. It's so shadowed to the point where you don't see it, almost like a cheat in a way. Like, you're, instead of giving detail, you're hiding detail.
For sure. I mean, like, even if you were to go check out the backup story to this issue, it's still by Buscema, but this time you have inks by Palmiotti. And it couldn't be, you know, more like light and day. Like, it's so different. It's much more readable, and all the characters are more clear. There's just a better vibe to it. It's not quite as dour and depressing. It's the exact same penciler. It's just you have someone else doing the inks, and you really get a sense of how different an inker can take over and maybe derail an artist's vision.
Yeah, totally. But this is also like a flashback story, right, in regards to Peter's life. So I guess it kind of lends itself to a better time, perhaps.
Yeah, but there's still portions that are done during the, you know, the present day.
Yeah, that's true. No, you're right.
And they don't look, you know, again, it doesn't look like it's suffocating. I just feel like the inks are suffocating the pencils.
Yeah, that's a good point. I like that description.
But it, you know, the issue itself isn't bad. It's kind of an interesting, you know, again, you have this new Green Goblin again, and they kind of have a kind of a weird team up against this new character, which doesn't really go anywhere. But again, you're developing that there is a new character here, and then eventually he's going to get a book of his own, which at the time I don't think was publicized anywhere. But again, I don't remember kind of what the hubbub was at the time. But I don't think they were really kind of saying what was going to happen next.
Right.
Because it would be a while. It would be, I think, 4 or 5, 6 months. And I think in the meantime, you had the Spider-Man Legacy of Evil one-shot that came out.
Right.
So then we got the Trial of Peter Parker. Now, I'm gonna gloss this over a little bit because there's a lot going on and also not a lot going on at the same time. Like, there's a lot of just extended action sequences throughout this. Mm-hmm. And, like, you have, you know, again, Peter Parker's going on trial for the fact that, you know, really Ben Reilly is standing in his place, that, you know, he is thought to have done all these murders. You have a lot of Spider-Man and Kane fighting each other, which doesn't feel like it really goes anywhere, except for, again, Kane really hating Ben Reilly. Again, you have a lot of the detective character who is branded by Kane, who I do like as a character, and I think they DeMatteis definitely did a lot to develop that character in the Lost Years book. We also have Stunner still around because, again, she's a viable supporting character at this point in time, and I kind of miss when she disappears. Really, Kane just wants to be able to go and screw up the trial, and at the same time, you have Stunner being like, Kane is mine, and, you know, being very over the top, and then Traveler kind of just makes people disappear.
What did you think of the different art within that first part of the Trial of Peter Parker? You got the police artist, they say here, from Roy Burdine, and then the courtroom artists, Randy Eberlin and Don Hudson. Did you like that change or that shift in tone between the scenes of what's happening action-wise and then what's happening within the courtroom?
Now, is that actually – isn't that just – aren't the courtroom artists just two different anchors?
I'm not sure.
Or is that who Kroll and Crespi and Babcock are? Because it just says they're stenographers, but what does that actually mean? Like,
I think that might be anchors. I think that I'm not sure, but
I guess you're right. There is a noticeable difference between the way in which people are illustrated at the courtroom,
yeah,
and then later on when you see like the really exaggerated detective face, like that's not the same artist.
Right. Exactly.
It's, you know, if you're ever going to have two different artists on a book and not have a jar in tone, having completely different scenes that don't overlap is probably the best way to do it.
Yeah, I agree. It's much more noticeable when you have those two or three pages when suddenly the art changes in the issue and it's within the same story or the same sequence and you're like, ooh, that was rough. But this works, I guess.
Now, in the next issue, again, you have Mark Bagley on art, and again, I am such a Bagley fanboy, so I have to, I guess, check that at the door, but his art is just such a breath of fresh air here, and here it's suddenly Judas Traveler is putting Spider-Man on trial, and this is, again, more fun. It's definitely an interesting juxtaposition with the, you know, the real trial going on about Peter Parker, but instead you have, you know, Spider-Man going on trial against all his villains, which is pretty interesting, and eventually, you know, Carnage finds out who Peter Parker is, like, a lot of people know who he is, eventually it all gets mind wiped, so it doesn't end up really mattering at all, but it's a fun divergent nonetheless.
Yeah, no, the art in this is beautiful.
And then we go into Spider-Man, which is, you know, issue 60, The Trial of Peter Parker, part 3 of 4. This is all about the face of Kane, which is, you know, at the time would have been a very exciting reveal. It's written by Howard Mackey, art by Tom Lyle, with Hannah and Rubenstein on finishes. So it's back up to, you know, Lyle's usual standards. It looks great. A lot of action here. With Kane and Spider-Man fighting each other. Again, you have more and more about the courtroom drama and Peter kind of bringing Kane to the courtroom to kind of be like, he's the one who did this. It's interesting to when we finally get to see the reveal that Kane is the first clone because, I mean, you're reading this now, and this is a foregone conclusion. You know who Kane is from the beginning.
Right.
Like, how do you feel the reveal is carried out?
It's tough. I was just about to mention that because on the first volume of the Clone Saga collections, you read the miniseries from the last years from Jam DeMatteis, which is extremely well done with the JRJR artwork. So I've been reading three volumes kind of knowing or having an idea of who Kane is. And now we also know who Kane is from current continuity, right? So with this reveal, I was trying to imagine what it would have been like to have this, and if there was any sort of tells within the story thus far that indicates that it's pretty obvious that he's also a clone, since he's so interconnected and obsessed with making sure certain things don't happen to Peter, and his obsession with Ben Reilly, but then his desire to make sure that Mary J doesn't die. So I'm not sure what it is like. Well, how about you, having read it? You read it years later too, right? So what was your reaction? Did you think they executed it well? It's not bad. I don't think it's bad.
I think they did it in an exciting way that, you know, it's interesting that, you know, Kane wouldn't have in any way told anyone before, but it's an interesting way of kind of showing, of pushing Kane to have to reveal it. The fact that he doesn't want Peter Parker's life ruined, but he only wants Ben Reilly to die because, again, Ben, it's unclear, like, at this point, how he's supposed to believe this, like, which one he's supposed to believe is real, because the Lost Years, again, definitely kind of messes with that a little bit, too, but I guess the idea is that, you know, Kane believes that that Ben Reilly's a clone and wants to kill the clone, so he wants the original Peter to be able to live a good life, so the fact that Peter's about to unmask himself to be able to prove that he didn't do these deaths, or didn't kill these people that Peter's on trial for, it tracks. It's interesting now because we're so used to DNA that the idea that, you know, there's other guys around there, that they're not going to figure this out or not be like, hey, it's the identical DNA to Peter, but it's this other guy. Like, their way of getting around it is Kane basically grabbing someone and giving them the mark of Kane, which is brutal. And that's everyone would kind of go, oh, well, he's the only guy who could do that. So obviously he must be, you know, the correct perpetrator. It's an interesting way of getting out of it. And then at the end of the issue, in a very comic book way, Kane's like, I've prevented my worst fear from coming true. I'm going to do what I wasn't able to do for years and carry out your execution and just running towards Ben Reilly.
Right.
Very comic books.
Well, it's the 90s, man. It has to be that way.
No, that's just comic books in general.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. I think this is the point, though, where you start to feel that the event or the whole saga has dragged on to a point where it's taken them way too long to get to this point for, I mean, the build up is really nice, but then we're kind of like, okay, we got to get on with this because we've been almost like running around in circles. And with all of the material that's printed within these volumes, you really feel how much they were just trying to squeeze everything they could out of this thing.
I actually will disagree with you a little bit because I feel like this isn't where it goes off the rails. The next storyline is where it goes off the rails.
No, I think definitely the next storyline is where it goes off the rails, but it's the amount of time that it took to get here. That's what I refer to.
Yeah, it definitely has been a lot of time. But I mean, I guess in comic, again, you're getting 4 issues a month, so it's actually not as much time as it feels like.
That's true.
Because you're getting so much content every month.
That's true.
But yeah, no, and what I like about this issue too, so I'm sorry, the next issue, part four, is that you not only have Kane, you know, going to prison, you think that you're resolving something. You think that you're finally, you know, in the clear, they figured out Peter's not going to jail. You know, what more could they possibly, you know, put on these people? And then you get the reveal of who's actually the clone, which, if you think about it, is kind of a very sneaky climax, because that's not in any way kind of indicated that you're going to get that when you read this issue.
Well, it's on the cover. They say it's
on the
cover.
Yeah, but I feel like, do you actually, like, if you were reading this at the time, do you actually think it's going to prove that the Peter you've been watching all this time isn't the real Peter? Like, it just feels like, as much as it says that, it feels like that's just going to be typical hyperbole. Like, yeah, the one true Spider-Man revealed, I'm sure, whatever. And then you get there, like, holy shit.
I don't know. I think it was being telegraphed too much that what they were going to do was a big switch. It was the era of taking away the hero. So for them to be like, at last, the one true Spider-Man revealed, you knew something big was going to happen. I don't think they weren't going to do something finally. But I don't know. I think at this point it's kind of been telegraphed that there's going to be a big switch here. You don't think so? You think they would have just stuck with, yep, Peter's the real one after all this time?
I think they could have. I think they could have. I mean, obviously, they had kind of had a directive, then they were going to dump Peter. Like that, as much as they ended up reversing the decision eventually, that's what they were going to do. And they were going to do that and move forward with a new era, which was not the Clone Saga anymore. It was just the Ben Reilly era. So, I mean, I'm not sure. I feel like people may not have expected that they were going to make that decision. But then the minute they do it, they definitely like lean really hard on the Peter's crazy.
Yeah, right? Totally.
Like, again, the part of to do that is to make you okay with it as a reader that, oh yeah, well, you know, the Peter I've been watching all these years probably wouldn't have done this. Now, that being said, if you remember the original Clone Saga they were mentioning from the 70s, when Peter first finds Gwen Stacy in his apartment, he thinks he's freaking lost his mind. He actually sits there thinking about how he's crazy, talking to the Spectre of Spider-Man and being like, I'm nuts.
Which would make sense for anybody to be going through that when someone dies in your arms and then you see them on your doorstep.
Well, for sure.
Like,
and the big thing here, again, is that you have Peter hitting MJ unintentionally, but you know, being in such a rage and going so crazy, which the last time he did this, I don't know if you remember, but you know, he did kill someone in Spider-Man versus Wolverine basically the exact same way. He's really gonna watch it,
right? I think that was where I guess we'll get into it as we unfold more of the volumes, but they're really going out of their way, I feel, to make the Peter Parker we've been following all these years very unlikable. Like, it's almost way too heavy-handed to make him crazy, to make him unstable and unlikable, and that Ben Reilly is the guy that, you know, where he's the level one. He's the one that we can lean on and know what to expect from him. This other guy, get him out of here kind of thing. I felt that they were doing that. And every now and then, they bring him back and make him and MJ, you know, reconcile and everything's going to be okay, but it's getting too heavy-handed.
And then we have an issue that I loved as a kid, but now I realize really serves not a lot of purpose, is Spider-Man The Jackal Files. I would have been, 11 or 12 years old when I bought this, and I loved it because it gave me a lot of information on a lot of different characters.
These are the best things to have as a kid, like these little dossiers that just give you a rundown. I love these things.
And just like the Stripes Strike File, this is told from the perspective of the Jackal, which is interesting as well. So you start with, you know, Scarlet Spider, and you have a lot of different artists. You actually have Mark Buckingham does the Scarlet Spider, and it's gorgeous.
Yeah. Now, I noticed that in this, all the different artists that show up and give you – I think even George Perez has some art on this.
He does the Spider-Man right here. It's actually a really nice piece.
Yeah, and I can't think of too many times that he's drawn Spider-Man. I know he did in, you know, the Infinity Gauntlet and things like that, but I can't think of any standout George Perez Spider-Man.
No, I can't either. And then we have Patrick Zerker does the Kane. Let's see, Jackal is by, I want to say, Don – for Dan Lawless. Joe St. Pierre does, I guess, the Gwen, the Mary Jane, which are okay, but they're not the most fantastic versions of those. Guy Dorian does the Carrion, which you can kind of tell because on the tombstone it even says Guy Dorian and Scott Koblish.
Oh.
In case you weren't sure, you got Michael Blair does the Shriek. It's kind of a who's who of the 90s characters that were big at the time. I think Patrick Zerker again does the new Warriors, and I think he had been the regular penciler in and around this period, so it made sense that he was the one contributing that picture. And it's, again, it's interesting to look at because, you know, this is not the new Warriors a lot of people think of.
Right.
Like, you got power packs on here. Like, you're like, who?
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Who else we got? Let's see. That was Patrick Zerker. Then we got more from St. Pierre. Not a great version of the Hobgoblin, unfortunately. Yeah, Jordan Raskin, Liam Sharp. So, you know, some of the people that, you know, you would know now, but probably would not have known at the time. And I'm just trying to see here. Blair. I know Pat Olive does a page, and I'm not sure which page he does. He might do some of the technical stuff.
Okay, yeah. I think some of the background stuff, like in the Silver Sable, that looks maybe like it could be a Pat Olive Spider-Man behind her.
Yeah, maybe. No, that's Blair, too. This Michael Blair person. Actually, that's good. So that's page 22, which means 22, 23, 24, 25. So it looks like the Pat Olive would be the Scryer.
Okay.
Which is, you know, it's actually a very nondescript page.
Yeah, and
his... Oh, you know what? The page is, now that I look at it, the face is completely a Pat Olive.
There you go.
I should have been able to tell. Oh, that's going to bug me.
Lose sleep. You should lose sleep now over that one.
I know, I really should. I should call him up and be like, I'm so sorry I didn't realize this was you. Then we got an issue of New Warriors, issue 61. That's the Maximum Clonage prologue. Maximum Clonage is so terrible, I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about this.
Thank you. I didn't really care to.
So you have this New Warriors issue. It's all about, you know, this Spider-esque character who's Spider-Side breaking into this facility. You end up having the New Warriors kind of confronting the New Warriors really needed something to kind of keep them relevant at this point or something to help their sales go up. So they were kind of folded into the Spider office, and so they ended up having a crossover. They ended up having Ben Reilly on the team. This is all to try and bring up their sales. Because sales of everything Spider-Man related and Clone Saga related kept going up, even though, yes, maybe the content wasn't great. I will say Maximum Carnage Alpha had a fun cover because it was in one of those overlay covers that you used to see. So that was kind of fun. But otherwise, Alpha is just a mess.
This was a book that I always really, really wanted as a kid because of the cover. And I felt like this was, like the cover says, the Alpha Omega moment of the Clone Saga. This is when you're, in my head as a kid, you're in the thick of it. This is what it all embodies. But now looking back at it, I'm like, oh boy. This is rough going reading this stuff here.
Yeah, it's pretty rough. It's not great. And actually, yeah, I'm just reading through it. I'm like, how does Peter even get? No, hold on, that is Ben Reilly. Okay, sorry, I'm just trying to see. Like, there's so much crazy stuff that happens in this issue. You have Kane breaking out of custody. You have Spider-Side. You have him fighting against New Warriors. You have Ben being confronted by them, thinking that he's Spider-Side. You have Peter deciding he's going to leave, but then deciding, you know, no, I am Spider-Man, which, to be honest, ends up doing this cycle for like a month or two of Peter deciding that he should step aside, but then not stepping aside for some reason. It's a rough issue. You have the Punisher being brought in, which seems more out of left field than it actually is, because obviously the Punisher was first introduced as a guy who was manipulated by the Jackal. So it does make sense to have him involved, but otherwise it's such a mess.
And during this story, if memory serves, this is where Peter is deciding to join the Jackal. It might be in his best interest to join the Jackal family because, well, hey, I'm a clone after all, and this is technically my father, which it just seems so forced.
Everything here is forced. It doesn't make any sense for him suddenly to take such a heel turn. Basically, the idea, I accept the idea that finding out that you're a clone and you're the fake would be very upsetting, especially considering that, you know, he's been spending time with Ben Reilly, but he hadn't really understood what it meant to be a clone and what it meant to lose your sense of identity. So now he's losing that and going through that all himself. And, you know, he does not take it well. He kind of, you know, again, teams up with the Jackal. It's just a messy storyline, and the Jackal's, you know, big plan basically is that he's going to overpopulate the world with clones, which doesn't really make a lot of sense. The one nice thing that happens as a result of the storyline is that the Jackal dies and is kind of removed from the playing board because they didn't really have anything to do with him. Like, he was interesting back in the day, But then the more they made him like a genetically engineered guy, as opposed to just a dude in a costume who was obsessed with Gwen and made clones, like that was much more Spider-Man villain. And then he just became this weird, crazy villain that didn't make a lot of sense. You have so many different artists taking place on these different books. By the end of the storyline, you still have them not sure who's going to be Spider-Man, which, again, it's like you spend, you know, four or five issues, and you haven't gotten anywhere. Actually, it's 6 issues. So you've done all these issues, and then you have not gotten anywhere at all, and then you're still at the same main question of what happens next. Like, it's just such a mess. It's when this type of stuff happens that gives the Clone Saga its bad name. It's this that makes everyone feel like it's just a cash grab and not an actual story anymore. And it's hard to refute that.
Yeah, this to me, like you said a word just a little while ago, you called it the heel turn. It does feel like a really, really bad wrestling storyline where they went so far trying to get something to happen for it to pay off. And when the payoff time came, nothing went the way that they wanted it to go typically. And so they kept going with it, trying to force it down your throat, but it just didn't stick the landing. And nothing here feels earned. And throwing it almost was like, let's throw this in there, let's throw that in there, and make sure the Punisher's involved just to spike sales or to keep things, unexpected as you're turning the page. And it just was just reading this, I'm like, is this over yet? Can we move on?
So it's funny because I remember when you were reading this, you were like, I don't know if I can make it to book 5.
Yeah, no, it's true.
And I told you, like, this is the rough spot. Like, you know, it starts out really promising. There's some really good ideas in the first few volumes. And then it goes on a little longer. You get, you know, fill-in artists here and there. You know, it starts to feel like they're just kind of trying to push things together as opposed to feeling like the creative teams are excited about what they're doing. And it starts to feel more perfunctory. And again, by the time you're done book 4, I don't blame you for being like, I don't know if I want to continue with this. You know, you start off the volume pretty promising, and then it becomes something else. And then what did I tell you? I told you, read book 5. Book 5 starts off rough too, but will get better. And then I told you, you got to get to Ben Reilly. But just, you know, skip Ben Reilly book 1. But book 2 is great. And I'm not sure if you actually took me up on that.
I have not taken you up on that yet, but it's on sale digitally, so I might pick those up digitally right now.
Okay, so let's jump into book 5. We have some New Warriors issues, which, again, this was a way of them trying to spike sales by putting Ben Reilly on the team. It doesn't really fit in well with continuity either because it's just kind of a mess. But, you know, it's kind of fun to see him there and kind of see how he interacts with the New Warriors at the time. After this particular issue, you have half of the super specials that were collected in a different volume. I can't even remember which volume.
I think it was the Planet Symbiote ones. This was the flip book to the Planet Symbiote books. Am I right?
Yeah, which was like a while ago. Like, that, I'm always curious about their decision to put it over here because I believe it was, you know, you had the Planet Symbiote ones in book 3 of this,
yeah,
and yet they pushed this portion of it this far along in the timeline, which I don't think actually makes sense because, again, it took place a lot earlier. This is actually not a bad story. The artwork is definitely not the best. It's kind of, you know, a lot of people, it's almost like they're doing some tryouts for, you know, people who could eventually be you know, regular artists, but this is, even though it's a, you know, a super special or basically an annual, the artists are not really up to snuff. You got, you know, Todd Smith doing breakdowns in one issue with Sal Buscema doing finishes to give it some artistic and, you know, not integrity, consistency is what I meant. But I actually like it because it starts to create a world for the Scarlet Spider to be part of in a civilian identity. It creates a new version of a lizard, which is kind of cool, which is a different character. I like this a lot. As a kid, I remember I only ever read chapter 5. It was only as an adult that I was able to read chapter 4, maybe. It was only as an adult I was able to read the rest. But I really enjoyed this. You know, again, the art is definitely hit and miss, but I thought the rest of it was pretty enjoyable.
Yeah, the art leaves something to be desired, especially I think it's issue 4 of this. There's a picture of Ben Reilly swinging and his arm looks dislocated in the way that it's drawn. But when I was reading this, when I started reading this little miniseries that was the flip book of the Planet Symbiote, I was like, do I really gotta sit through this and read it? But the completist in me was like, let me do it. Let me make sure I'm not missing anything. And as the story went on, by like issue 2, issue 3, I was in. Like, I was actually invested in what was happening with the character. And I actually appreciated the fact that it was a standalone story for Ben that I can enjoy him on his own as a character without all of the other noise that's taking place. So I did actually enjoy the story, but it was weird reading it now, like you said, having the other half of it in volume three. And I think that's kind of sometimes what throws you off with this, is where does this all fit into the grand scheme of things? Even the planet symbiote, where does that fit in? And like you said, it seemed like they were cash grabs to sell Spider-Man books, but also to give people tryouts, people you've never heard of, artists you've never seen before, and see if they can hack it, basically.
So here's a question. For the flip book, which side do you think was better?
If I were to choose which one I would want to read without knowing, I would pick the Planet Symbiote, because that seems more intriguing to have Venom, Spider-Man, and Ben Reilly in a book.
Mm.
But after reading them, I think that maybe just the solo Ben Reilly story was a little bit more entertaining.
Yeah, I can see that.
How about
one
you?
One thing I really like at the end of the Ben Reilly story, which I don't think they ever really capture, or it's months and months and months before you ever see anything about that character again. But there's a moment at the very end when Scarlet Spider is calling Mrs. Connors and Billy to let them know that it wasn't, you know, that they've taken out the lizard, thinking that it's Kurt. Because I guess at the time they still think it's Kurt. I'm just realizing this. This is a different lizard.
So this wasn't Kurt. I didn't even catch that.
This is not Kurt Connors.
Okay.
Yeah, you know. Now that I realize it, I don't think they ever tell you, because it's not. It may have been a retcon later that this is not the real Kurt.
Yeah, there's nothing in it that indicates that it isn't Kurt, because even the family's reaction and Ben Reilly's
interaction with him. So again, I'm letting future continuity color something there. But yeah, no, it's not Kurt Connors. But at the end, it's definitely this weird. You know, the family's disappeared; they're gone. And I always, that's kind of an interesting, like, what happens next with those characters. Mm-hmm. And eventually, you will see them again. Obviously, actually, but before the Clone Saga is over, you'll see Kurt Connors return.
Okay.
Another reason for you to pick up the Ben Reilly complete collection.
You're a hard salesman.
That's hilarious. And then, I always liked this issue as a kid. Exiled Part 104, Who Will Wear the Webs? Well, don't worry. It's not going to be solved this month. It's going to be another month until you actually get to see the answer to that question. And this is part of the problem, right? You have marketing. You have people thinking that we're finally going to get a resolution. And they keep pushing it off. Now, there's a lot of internal pressures happening at Marvel at this point. When they finally do decide that they're going to have Ben Reilly take over, the marketing department's like, wait a minute. Over in the X office, we canceled all the books, did 4 months of The Age of Apocalypse, and sold like gangbusters. We should do the same thing for Spider-Man. And they're like, no, we don't want to do that. And they're like, no, you got to do this. We're marketing. We basically run the show now. So they decide, well, how about we only do it as a one-month thing? And they're like, do it for two. And I'm like, fine, I guess we will. So we have 2 months that'll come out, which is at the beginning of the Ben Reilly epic, that they were basically forced into, really pushed them out. They were not good stories. The art was terrible. It's part one of those things that a lot of those writers have said they kind of regret, but they were just so under the gun to produce this material that they were not connected to, and it was not starting the new direction that they were hoping to. And that was the, you know, it was a whole month where it was, you know, Web of Scarlet Spider number one, Scarlet Spider number one, Amazing Scarlet Spider number one, Spectacular Scarlet Spider number one. And it was just a 2 month stunt. And then you had the return of Spider-Man, which was how it was marketed. And you had Ben Reilly as Spider-Man in his new costume.
So in these exiled issues, that's what this is taking place concurrently with Age of Apocalypse, all at the same time?
In and around that same period.
Okay.
It's interesting too, because you had this because the X-Men books sold so well. The X-Men books were all on a high gloss paper stock. In fact, for months leading up to Age of Apocalypse, you actually had the choice to have a regular newsstand issue or a deluxe edition. And the deluxe edition was more expensive, but it looked nicer and had better printing. And then you had the Age of Apocalypse happen, which I believe is only available in the deluxe format, that it was just only available with that nicer, they never really went back to the newsprint, whereas Spider-Man was still being on the regular kind of matte finish, newsprint at this time. They hadn't progressed to a glossier finish yet.
Mm, got you. So these issues, if I'm looking at the covers correctly, they hadn't been retitled yet, had they?
No. So that won't be until after Spectacular Spider-Man 229.
Okay. Just to be clear. Got you. Did you like this exiled storyline?
Yeah, I thought it was all right. I mean, I loved Black Cat being in it and kind of seeing how she's dealing with what's going on with the fact that, you know, her Peter wasn't the real guy, and her kind of meeting Ben and having a bit of a flirtation with him, I thought was interesting. Again, you have more of this back and forth with Peter trying to take off his mask and give it to, you know, to Ben, and then both kind of not deciding on anything, and, you know, Ben kind of saying, I make a pretty good Ben, you make a pretty good Peter, and it just kind of feels like, make up your mind, guys. And I'm not talking about these guys. I'm talking about Marvel. Like, are we going to get, you know, is Peter going to be Peter, or is Peter going to go away? And again, they were trying to figure this out. And is Peter going to be Spider-Man, or is Ben Reilly going to be Scarlet Spider? Like, again, they weren't sure what to do about this. And even at the end of this issue, Ben Reilly's like, I'm taking off. This is the best for everyone. But obviously, he's not going to get very far.
Right.
Which is frustrating, but also the stories are still entertaining because I feel like these issues at least felt like they still had a handle on who these characters were.
Right. Yeah. I like the Vulture storyline as well. Like, I, as much as I was getting impatient trying to come to a resolution, I was still, like you said, finding myself entertained with the stories that they were running monthly at the very least. So it was, I was okay with it, but I do feel the same as you in regards to they're fishing this along too long now. Where if I was buying this on the stands, I would have dropped it, because I feel like they did something similar to this when they did the new Krypton with Superman, and they were tying it into Supergirl and this and that and the other, and it was like, I don't want to read all these extra books that you're forcing on me to make it seem like it's going to pay off when we're just dragging the story and losing its steam now, sort of thing. And I think at this point that happened.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I guess I can see it happening. However, I'm reading through this storyline, and again, I think as a reader at the time, it was still exciting because you think Ben's going to leave, and then he's like, no, I can't leave. I can't do this, and you have some flashbacks to his time with Seward, which was very interesting and something that was far overdue.
Yeah.
There's been great artwork in the second issue by Derek Robertson. And then you have this reveal of these tentacles, and you're like, oh my God, is it Doc Ock? Like, again, at the time, Doc Ock just died, and now you see that these tentacles, what does this mean? You get to the next issue by Pat Broderick and Chris Ivey on art with Howard Mackey on script, and again, kind of an interesting perspective on what Ben is going through and with Seward, and again, more of the flashbacks and, you know, who's keeping him, you know, captive, which is interesting. And I guess we don't even really get to see who that is yet, but we get this idea that there's something going on. You have the Spider-Man Unlimited, which again was this quarterly book. And then you have, the Vulture actually in that, which I think of the four part, storyline for Exiled, I think it was actually the least enjoyable part, to be honest. I think the rest of it was more interesting. But, you know, again, anything you can kind of get to keep Scarlet Spider entertained and, you know, still in the book in a way that makes sense. It's much better than what we get right after this, because you get this storyline, which is okay, but again, it's an unlimited book. The art's not always as great. But it's kind of an interesting, you know, Ben Reilly, Ben Parker story. The next issue, so atrocious, is Time Bomb Part 1, Spectacular Spider-Man 228. Again, this is where I really, as a kid, hated Sal Buscema because I didn't like Bill Sienkiewicz. Like, I think I hated the penciler because of what the inker did.
Yeah, I don't think they're a good. I think Bill Sienkiewicz is a guy who does his best on his own as opposed to inking somebody who's clearly got a specific style. And I don't feel like, you said, you should muddy up Sal Buscema's pencils, because there is a certain clarity to them. Like, it's very clear what his Spider-Man's supposed to look like. It's there's a simplicity, but also it's very clear what you're supposed to feel when you read it. And this one just gives it so that thickness. It's like an eyeliner all over the book.
It is. And I think part of the other problem with storyline is, so the artwork is its own problem. Storyline wise, retroactively, this storyline makes no sense. Because you basically, I guess it kind of does, but you have this post-hypnotic suggestion that Spider-Man basically has, that when Jackal dies, it activates this programming and he's going to try and kill Mary Jane, ostensibly because he's the clone. But I guess in Maximum Clonage, there was time for him to kind of do this to Peter, independent of him actually being a clone. The second issue is so much better artistically. Like, it's just such a nicer read. The characters are clear, concise. The action is exciting. Again, this is Stephen Butler and Randy Amberlin, and it's such a, it makes you realize just how enjoyable the first part of it might have been able to be if you had a different art team.
Yeah, and that first part, the cover with Spider-Man, I hated that cover. The Sienkiewicz Sal Buscema part 1.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it horrible. Was rough. Yeah, horrible.
Now, speaking of Ralph, you do a few issues of New Warriors, which if you're a big fan of Ben Reilly, he's there. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't really play a big part.
No. Yeah, these are sandwiched in, and it kind of felt jarring. Like, again, I'm like, there's a lot of New Warriors content in this book. I don't know if I really feel like reading it, which I did, again, to be the completist, but it didn't feel the most necessary. But you know what I did appreciate about it, which is a side note, tangent, but the seeing the New Warriors, what's is their name? Firestorm?
No, not Firestar.
Firestar, and what's her boyfriend's name? Alex, right?
Justice.
What's
his name? Justice?
Justice and Firestar, because they were later on in the Kurt Busiek Avengers, having a little bit of backstory of their relationship and kind of where they're coming from. Because I think later on, Firestar is still concerned about her health issues, right? So this is kind
of. That's right, very much so.
Yeah, so this kind of sets the table a little bit for what those characters will deal with later on. So I kind of appreciated that little continuity connection that I got to experience for the first time.
That's a very good point. Now, because it's the 90s, the next storyline is about virtual reality.
Oh, brother.
It gets much worse in the Ben Reilly Epic Volume 1 because there's a lot of virtual reality there.
The one that I don't need to read, right?
Yeah. Just because – and that's – it's not – you know what? It's one of those things where, like, when you read comics from the 60s, they're all about radioactive stuff, right? It's just all about, you know, it's all about the atom because, you know, that was still new and exciting and people didn't really know a lot about it, so they could kind of just do crazy stories with it. And that's right. Kind of the way the 90s were with, you know, VR, virtual reality, and the internet. And so like, you got this in Tree of Knowledge with Daredevil as well. Like, it's not – a problem with the storytelling itself. It's just, you know, they were doing something fun and exciting with a trope of the time, which right. has not aged well, but that's yeah. not their fault.
Yeah, no, it's true. I'm thinking too of like some of the television shows that we had during that time. Like you think of Reboot or I don't know if you remember Superhuman Samurai Cyber Squad. Like everything was very much in a virtual reality computer based. Like that's what you're fighting. Some techno virus of some sort. So yeah, it doesn't age well, but it was very prevalent. So it is what it is.
Yeah, and this is where you get the big reveal that, you know, it's the new Dr. Octopus. Now she's just Lady Octopus, which I don't like. I like that she was Dr. Octopus, too. I don't think they should take that away from her. Also, to timestamp this a little bit, you get a free overpower card inside.
I don't even remember what those were.
Oh, man. Like, I didn't play it, but my brother-in-law loved it. He would go to, like, tournaments. He was like a champion. He was really good at it. I never really played it myself, but it was a thing. It was a card game.
Okay, what did you think of Angel Medina's pencils in this?
On and off. There's some of it's really good, and some of it doesn't work as well. Like it's a weirdly awkward shot of him of Spider-Man carrying MJ partially in like a web sack next to him, which I feel like doesn't quite work.
Yeah. It
like, what are the physics of that? Like, it's on like the same arm. Like, there's like, where's it coming from?
Right.
But, I mean, it's fine. And, again, generally speaking, I think the art was good. Some of the faces were obviously a little bit more abstract. But some of the stuff I liked the shot of, like, Spider-Man with like, pants on, but just, like, his costume coming through, sitting in, like, with a VR rig I thought was kind of interesting. Like, generally speaking, I think that there was a lot of fun stuff here. The storyline was definitely, like, this is the moment here where Peter feels his unborn child move for the first time. That's super exciting, and I thought was a really kind of wonderful, beautiful moment that I thought he sold well. There's a lot here to enjoy. Again, they're about to wrap up. This isn't filler anymore. This is getting you to the main event, and I think that this storyline really speaks to that. Its quality speaks to the fact that they knew that this is where they were going. This wasn't, you know, them just kind of running in place. We're finally getting the good stuff.
Right. Yeah, no, I like that moment, too, where Peter and MJ were sharing that moment finally together, a little quiet moment, dinner time, kind of swanky, and then he feels the baby kick, and it continues on into the next issue where he's like so enamored by the fact that, you know, he realizes this baby is alive, it's real, it's going to happen for them. So it was a nice moment.
And they got Gil Kane to come back.
I know, that's awesome. I was just going to say.
Like, that's kind of crazy. Like, and again, that's something I never would have noticed or appreciated as a kid, but now I'm like, holy crap, they got Gil Kane to come back?
Yeah, with Tom Palmer on the inks, which, I mean, I think these pages look great.
Yeah, now you can tell that it doesn't all work. You know, it's not all perfect. There's a few shots that maybe are a little rushed or, you know, not their best. But generally speaking, again, I like the issue. I like the use of Carolyn Trainer. Again, this feels like good stuff. And then just when you're ready for part three, no, let's go to Spider-Man team-up featuring the X-Men first.
Yeah, it was...
This would have been, if you look at it, $4.15 Canadian. This would have been more expensive then than a brand new comic now.
This would almost be like, what was the size of this at the time, this issue? Was it at least a 60-page issue?
No, I think it was probably 48.
That's an expensive book for 96.
It's very expensive, especially when you have books like Untold Tales of Spider-Man going for a buck.
Yeah, but again, this is a Spider-Man X-Men team up during, you know, this what had the Age of Apocalypse ended yet for these X-Men to be back?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay, so this would have been exciting for people to buy.
I guess so. Right. You're right. You're absolutely right, but it's terrible.
No, it is. It's not good.
So I'm not going to talk about it. Let's move on. So we got Spectacular Spider-Man, 229, the giant-sized extravaganza, The Greatest Responsibility, Part 3, The End of an Era and the Beginning of a New One. But not really, because then you have 2 months of another book, which is Discount Spider Books, and then you finally have Sensational Spider-Man number 0. But this was an issue I liked as a kid. I do think that the inks are still a little overwrought. I don't think they're nearly as bad as they were previously. You get some great homages to Steve Ditko here with Spider-Man, struggling to be under a lot of machinery, and then you have Scarlet Spider actually helping him, which I thought was an interesting kind of way to pass the torch as well. You finally have Peter deciding to, you know, not be Spider-Man anymore, and he kind of gives the costume over and walks away, and then you think that's it, you know, and you have this great moment with Ben Reilly kind of strutting forward. You can practically hear the soundtrack of Saturday Night Fever as he's strutting down, and you think it's all over, but then it's not over. And I think this is the big problem that people have with the Clone Saga, is that you have this great moment. This is the moment. This is the moment where, you know, Ben decides he can be Spider-Man now, but they won't let him be Spider-Man because marketing won't let them. They have to do these 2 months of crap fill-ins first before they can actually let him take on the role. So instead of having this great passing of the torch moment where Peter gives him the costume and says, you know, I have this greater responsibility to my family now. I can't just be Spider-Man anymore. It's got to be you. That's a great moment. Why not just let that be it? But they couldn't do it.
In this issue, I just wanted to go back. What did you think of the spider fins when they jump into the water and they web fins on their feet to help them swim?
You know what? Whatever.
That was horrible. When I saw that, I'm like, oh, brother, this is so bad. But the issue itself was good. And you're right. That moment at the end was kind of what we've all been waiting for. When you read these and you get to that point, do you feel – I guess maybe you do. I kind of know the answer to this. But do you feel Ben Reilly is Spider-Man?
Yes and no. I feel like he hasn't quite earned it all yet, but he's getting there.
Yeah. That was my issue with Volume 5. I enjoyed and was entertained by all of it, surprisingly. Most of the Clone Saga, I actually enjoyed reading. I wasn't tortured by it. There were some parts that were like, oh, this is, you know, having to go through the maximum clonage or Planet Symbiote. A lot of this is just wasted space or stories that I don't want to read. But I like the little miniseries that are included in all these things that aren't directly called Clone Saga Part whatever. It's, you know, Time Bomb or I forgot what the first miniseries, Power and Responsibility and all those things. Like, I like those series. But at the end, I'm in this volume, I'm like, you're force feeding the whole Ben Reilly being Spider-Man thing, and I'm just not convinced. You haven't done a good job selling me that this guy is Spider-Man. And
I think there's two things they have to sell you on, and so this is a gripe I've always had with this complete collection, is that I feel like it shouldn't end there. It should end with the first issue that's in the Ben Reilly epic, which has no right being there, which is a one-shot called Spider-Man: The Parker Years. And it, so there's two things. You have to have, you have to buy into Peter walking away from being Spider-Man, and you have to buy into Ben Reilly being good enough to be Spider-Man. So you haven't totally been convinced, and I'm actually okay with that, because I feel like him finally taking on the Spider-Man mantle that first month is about him realizing that he deserves it, and he's good at it, and he can be Spider-Man. So I feel like that's okay that they haven't quite sold you on it yet. But they haven't, at least in this complete collection, the way it's been packaged, haven't done a good job explaining to you why Peter is actually able to walk away. Like, you get a good sense of it at the end of that issue, but you haven't, it hasn't really happened yet. And you have this amazing one shot that they did publish called Spider-Man the Parker Years, and it's all about Peter from reminiscing about all the things he did as Spider-Man. And it's a great way of, for someone who's new and doesn't really know a lot about Spider-Man, to pick up a lot of Spider-Man history really quickly with so much continuity packed into it. It's so much fun. It's all about Peter reminiscing and talking about it with MJ, and then finally making the decision that it's time for them to start their family, put all these things behind. You know, he webs up this box and they decide to move on with their own family. And I feel like that issue was sorely missing.
Yeah, I think having that issue would have been vital. And I think
it still exists. It's in the next collection, but it just feels weird that it's not in this one.
Right. I don't feel, though, I don't, maybe retroactively my mind is coming up with these rules, but I don't ever feel it was a good idea to make Peter Parker, quote unquote, the clone, and Ben Reilly the real one after all this time. If they would have left it up in the air and unknown until one of them had to die, would have been better, I think. But even if Peter had remained the real one and Ben Reilly was taking over, I would have been fine with that too. But to try to convince us that everything that you've read has been a fake Spider-Man, I think is a real cheat to the reader. Regardless of how much they were like, no, we meant it, we wanted it to count, we wanted to bring Peter back to his, you know, we wanted to get rid of the marriage by bringing back the, you know, Peter who was single and had his regular everyday life, just struggling to make it. They wanted to bring the status quo back. I don't think they had to do it like this. To make the Peter who, you know, was buried for 2 weeks with Kraven's Last Hunt, and the one that we've fallen in love with beyond Gwen Stacy having died. Like, there's so much spider history there that you're saying is like, it wasn't even him. It's a cheat.
Here's the thing. You may think it's a cheat, but at the time, it was enough to make people want to pick up Spider-Man, though, right? Like, are they really ballsy enough to do this? Is this really going to happen? You know, who's this other guy? Like, you know, it made waves, and it, at the time, at least showed that they were willing to take drastic changes and really willing, able to do things with their characters that you may not have thought they would ever have the balls to do. And that's kind of exciting. Like, you know, we read comics a lot now, and we kind of know that things are going to go back to the status quo. Well, what if there was a time when we didn't know that that was actually going to happen? You know, there's a reason why the 90s were exciting in a lot of ways, because, you know, Superman dies. What do you do next? How are you going to, like, obviously everyone's kind of like, well, you're going to bring him back, but how are you going to bring him back? How is that going to matter for the character? You break Batman's back. Well, how do you fix that? And what happens in the meantime? Like, all these exciting things. You have Hal Jordan goes freaking crazy and kills people and isn't Green Lantern anymore. Like, this is obviously, those are all DC examples, but you have a lot of crazy things happening to heroes to try and get people to care and push things and go the next, you know, 800 miles. And in that context, of course they were going to do this.
But do you think, though, with that in mind, did it actually pay off for them to make Ben Reilly the real Peter? Because in the long run, did they sell more comics as Ben Reilly being Peter Parker or Spider-Man, the real Spider-Man?
It did both. So as long as the Clone Saga was going, sales were still going up. And then once it was kind of ended and then you had Ben Reilly taking over, eventually sales started to sag a little bit. Now, it's hard to say how much of that is because of the product and how much of it is because of the time period, because sales were dropping on everything. And now you had, you know, cheaper entertainment, video games, that kind of stuff coming up that didn't exist previously when comics were more in their heyday. So it's really hard to kind of strip out all those factors and not have them be part of the equation because it definitely skews it. I think, you know, I kind of think that they should have stuck to their guns in some ways, to be honest, because, you know, by saying that they were going to do this and then making a really big effort of it and then bringing in Ben Reilly and making him Spider-Man for a while and then immediately kind of starting the process to undo it, I think in general it made people not believe in changes they saw in comics. The more you see things happen and then get reversed, the less likely you are you're ever going to believe in them. And I think this is one of the big times when that started happening.
Yeah. I just don't think you would ever – I think people like their comfort zones, their comfort foods. And I think Spider-Man, Peter Parker being Spider-Man, is what people are comfortable with. So to suddenly be like, well, Ben Reilly is the real one, but he's Ben Reilly now. And like the Peter Parker that you know and love is he's off having a baby and Mary Jane is in love with a clone. Like it's
like you say that though, because but it's no good. Remember, like, you know, in 87, you had Spider-Man suddenly became married and that was very different. And people didn't go crazy.
It was Peter though. Like,
yeah, but the storyline itself was absolutely foisted upon the readership. It wasn't, you know, organically built. It wasn't this long relationship, and finally it led to them being together. It was literally 1 month he was with someone else, and now he's suddenly married. Like,
I agree. That's how quickly it happened. I agree. I don't think that storyline of them getting married was a strong one, but I don't feel that this was ever going to – I don't think it was ever going to have the impact or that this was going to matter the way they wanted it by saying, nope, Ben Reilly is the real one. I don't know. It just at the end of it, I was like, I don't believe it. And maybe it's because I know that
it's because, you know,
maybe
because at the time there was no indication they were going to bring Peter back as Spider-Man. Like they gave, you know, they rechristened Ben Reilly. They, you know, it was like almost a year full of his own stories. Like there was no real indication that they were going to suddenly right the ship and bring Peter back.
So, would you have been perfectly fine then with Ben Reilly being the real Spider-Man?
It's impossible to say, to be honest, but I think probably. I mean, eventually you get used to anything. Like, there was a time when I never thought I'd be able to be okay with Spider-Man not being married to MJ anymore and her basically not being a persona in the book. And I got over it because the stories were still entertaining, even though a major change had happened. So I think if you still told entertaining stories, even though it was with Ben Reilly, yeah, I'd still probably be a fan.
Okay. Yeah, I wonder if I continue reading how I'll feel about Ben Reilly, but I just reading this, even knowing ahead of time like he's the real Spider-Man, I just never felt it. I never felt it came through, even convincing myself of like he's the real Spider, because I like Ben Reilly. I like the clone, or like the whole 90s aspect of it, the suit, as ridiculous as it is. I maybe it's a throwback to my childhood. I enjoy it, but I never felt convinced. And it, when they were making Peter go crazy and you know, hitting MJ and ready to kill and all of those things, I just that part of the story, I was just like, this doesn't feel right. I was never sold on this being, it just seemed forced. It seemed hackneyed. But that's maybe me looking at it from knowing better, right? So
yeah, because you know how it turned out.
How it turns out, yeah. Well, we did it. All five volumes in two parts.
So do you feel like you need a long shower? Like, are you okay?
No. I love – you know what? I'm happy that I read them. I am. I enjoyed it. I don't regret it. I don't – the only part was the maximum clonage. That was it for me where I felt like this is really bad. But the rest of it, even the parts that – even some of the artwork, at the end of the day, it was what it was. And I'm happy that I was able to read such a big moment in Spider-Man history that, you know, took over the book for so many years, had it – even to this day. I mean, the Clone Saga still has an impact. You still feel the reverberations of it throughout the book. I mean, they just did a clone conspiracy. So obviously there's something to this that stuck around and mattered to people. And like you look at the people who wrote this book, you got some great creators on there. So I'm never upset about reading those guys' stories about Spider-Man.
All right.
So what's next? What rabbit hole are we going to travel down next? We got to think of that one.
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, you know, I've been thinking for a while. Like, you seem to be more of the DC guy between the two of us. I feel like you should bring me down a DC rabbit hole I haven't gone down.
Okay, I'll think of one. I'm trying to think if there's any good ones to... You want a 90s one or any?
You know, it could be anything. I mean, it could even be something I have already read, but maybe haven't read in a while. Like, I mean, there's some stuff where, like, I've done some deep dives. Like, have you read all the Denny O'Neill, The Question?
No, I haven't.
That's some interesting stuff. It's, I remember I picked it up because I loved The Question on the Justice League Unlimited cartoon. Okay. That is not the same question that I read in that comic.
Okay.
He's still cool, but he's so much cooler on the cartoon.
Should we do another 90s event of something similar to the clone, like the death of Superman, that whole saga there?
I mean, that's my sweet spot as a kid.
Okay, mine too. Maybe we could do that one next. I haven't read that in a while. I've read it plenty of times, but maybe we could do that one. Have you seen the recent
No, I don't want to watch that.
Yeah, you don't have to.
I don't like the art style. I just don't like the art style they've been using for them, so yeah. I just have no interest at all.
I just watched it today, and it was okay.
Well, that was a ringing endorsement.
Yeah, no, you know what? It was one of those things when they did the first remake of, because they did the Doomsday a long time ago, and I enjoyed that original one because I'm like, hey, this gave me hope of what they could do for other DC animated features. So when they redid this one with the continuity of that sort of Justice League movies that they've been putting out, like The War and mm-hmm. Throne of Atlantis, I'm like, okay, they're trying to tie this all in. And I was interested to see where they would go with The Reign of Superman because they never did that one before. And it didn't – it's very different from the original story, which is fine. But I don't – I feel different in a way that isn't better.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you have it on Netflix and you want to give it a whirl, go for it. But don't buy it. I'll let you borrow it.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much, dude.
You'll have to tell me what we're going to talk about and how and why, and we'll do this again sometime.
Sounds good, man. Thank you so much. What's coming up next for Comic Shenanigans? What we can look forward to?
Oh, my goodness. So I have some good stuff hopefully coming out in March sometime. I have Brian Reber, who's an amazing colorist, coming on the show. I'm working on getting Andy Runton of Owly fame on the show. I believe Brett Breeding we're looking at getting on the show in March, as well as getting Ron Garney back on the show. It's been, I think, 3.5 years since we've had him on the show. So I think that's what March looks like. And then who knows what happens in the future. At some point, I got to get Mark Waid back on the show, as well as Brian Augustin and a few others. So hopefully, you know, just keep on plugging away with more interviews.
That's all. You're a show off, but that's awesome.
Yeah. Hey, you did ask.
I know. I'm just playing with you.
Oh, actually, I should say on March 1st, you're going to be on the show for 2 hours.
Hey, there you go.
That's something to look forward to. Another appearance by Eric Anthony. Yeah, because we recorded that on what, February the 1st. So I thought, you know what? Let's let this sit a little, and then we'll have it on March 1st, and that'll be good. And I think in the meantime, I have an episode up with Alex Irvine coming out. This week, who wrote The Comic Book History of Baseball, which is a tremendous book, as well as he wrote Daredevil Noir, which I'm a huge fan of. So I talked with him for about an hour or so last week. And on the 18th, I'm going to be chatting with Judd Winnick again about High-Low Volume 5, I believe, his most recent young adult graphic adventure. I don't know what do you want to call it, but it's a great series. I'm really enjoying reading them with my son, so that's coming out. So we'll be recording that on the 18th, and that'll come out on, I guess, the 22nd. So it's going to be a busy February, and then again, all those things coming up in March, and who knows what will happen in April. Obviously, we'll do a reaction episode to a little movie called Avengers Endgame, but besides that, not sure what April will bring yet.
Awesome. Sounds good. Looking forward to it, man. Keep up the good work. Thank you for coming on the show
again. Thanks for having me for episode 150.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Adam. We'll be back in touch very soon.
Not to be a show-off, but I'll make sure to have you back for episode 700.
Sounds good.
I'm only 50 episodes away, so.
You're a jerk. 700, that's sick. All right, thanks, dude.
You're welcome.